This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 420 was produced on March 21st, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Saxo Bank's commodities chief Ola Hansen returns as this week's feature interview guest. Ola sees green shoots across the commodity sector. We'll discuss which commodities are hot and which are not, and what's driving the rally, from softs to ags to metals to energy. I have a special announcement for our Australian listeners this week. As you already know, nuclear energy is suddenly center stage in Australian political debate, with the sitting government holding fast to its anti-nuclear policies, while the opposition party is adopting a pro-nuclear stance as part of its campaign platform leading up to the 2025 federal elections. But neither side seems well informed on the latest nuclear technology developments in this debate. So I've been invited to give a talk on that subject on Wednesday evening, April 10th, at the Royal Automobile Club of Australia in the Sydney CBD. The title of my presentation will be Advanced Nuclear Energy: Secrets the Media and Politicians Haven't Told You. Early bird tickets to attend are $40, which goes to cover the cost of the room and AV equipment. There will also be a cash bar available. Now, the ticket price is going up after the early bird inventory sells out, so move fast if you want tickets. This event is sponsored by StratCon and Freelancer.com, and all proceeds will be donated to the Royal Automobile Club. This event is being promoted in Australia on several big mailing lists, and tickets are expected to sell out quickly. So if you'd like to attend, please use the link you'll find in your Research Roundup email to register, or just go to startcon.com/nuclear. That's STARTCON, like Start Conference, .com/nuclear. The event organizers have a small number of free tickets reserved for Australian government officials and members of the press. If you or someone you know qualifies in that regard, reach out to the event organizers via email to nuclear@startcon.com. I look forward to meeting some of you in Sydney on April 10th.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, March 21st, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures were up 103 basis points, trading at 52.86. The bull trend continues in the post-FOMC. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 56 basis points, trading at 103.37. The May WTI crude oil contract up 248 basis points, trading at 81.27. Oil bullishly broke out, but the big question now is how much bullish follow through will there be? We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The May RBOB gasoline up 264 basis points, closing at 272. The gasoline has been very strong, but approaching the resistance of the 2023 highs. The April gold contract up 37 basis points to 21.89, a bullish breakout in the post-FOMC. Will the bulls make it stick? Copper down 25 basis points to 405. Uranium up 650 basis points to 88.50. Uranium put in a swing low, but will we see bullish breakouts in the weeks to come? The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 8 basis points, trading at 4.27. The key news to watch next week will be the final GDP, the University of Michigan consumer sentiment, and the core PCE price index. This week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank's commodities chief, Ola Hansen. Eric, why did we get Ola back on the show this week?
Patrick, Ola Hansen has been around the commodity sector for his entire career. He's one of the most respected guys in the business, and I always enjoy our interviews. He's one of my favorite guests in the commodity space, so I'm really looking forward to this one.
Eric's interview with Ola Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ola Hansen, Head of Commodity Strategy for Saxo Bank. Ola prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview with some terrific graphs and charts, so you'll want to download that. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads above Ola's picture. Ola, it's great to have you back on the show. The title of the slide deck is Commodity Outlook for 2024. Last time we had you on, you said you thought maybe commodities were bottoming and starting to turn around. How are things looking?
Thank you very much, Eric, for inviting me back. Well, we have been bottoming out now for the best part of a year, and this is really quite an interesting time that we speak again, because I think if we look at some of the developments that have been seen across commodities so far this month, we're seeing some green shoots starting to emerge. Not only the precious metals, which really kicked off the rally at the start of the month, we're also seeing just recently some strengths coming back into industrial metals. The energy sector is after a prolonged period of sideways trading, showing signs as well of wanting at least to try to move higher. So we're basically asking the question whether this is it for the correction. And from a technical perspective, it seems like we are starting to break that downtrend that has been in place since the peak back in 2022.
Let's go ahead and dive into the slide deck starting on page 2. We're seeing what looks like the beginning of a breakout on this, or break above the trend line, I should say, on this chart. What's the chart and what's it telling us?
Well, simply that some of the strength that we have seen in some of the sectors is now becoming a bit more broad. I'm sure we all have seen all the headlines about our Coke chocolate bars getting more expensive. We'll talk about that in a second. But also the move we've seen somewhat perplexing a lot of traders in gold recently, how it just moved higher without really having any strong catalyst. And now just recently, also the tightness that's starting to emerge in the copper market is helping sending prices higher and also starting to sway investors and speculators back into the market, because many of these markets have been trading really with almost a neutral bias for quite a long time, simply because we haven't had any momentum in the market. So momentum is what is needed right now in order for some of these moves to stick, because they will attract fresh demand from funds who have been sidelined for a while here.
Looking at page 3 and your chart of all of the commodities, obviously cocoa, will come to that story in just a minute, but it seems like for the most part, everything is starting to look up. Not everything, I should say. Is there a trend here in terms of what we should understand from a macro perspective? Is this inflation driven? Is this driving inflation? Is it energy driven? Is it metals driven? What's the backstory here?
I think it's a combination of several things. There's no doubt that the headwinds that we've seen for the last year and a bit, year and a half almost, has been the rapid rise in interest rates. It's been lifting funding costs for many industries. It's led to a destocking of inventory levels, especially in metals, but also other commodities. And that has been weighing on prices. And now we're seeing some of the, and producers starting to respond to some of these developments. Not only are we're seeing production starting to be reduced in certain areas just in order to balance the market. That's underpinning prices. So basically saying that it's not only a question about demand, but supply obviously can be adjusted as well. And we're seeing some of that starting to emerge, places like natural gas. But then also the prospect for rate cuts, even though they have been lowered quite significantly in the last couple of months due to the continued data strength from the U.S. and sticky inflation, then the market is looking to price in an environment where funding costs starts to come down. So that's having an impact. And then the leftover from last year and with the weather developments, where we can only see we've had a north-south divide. The northern hemisphere harvest season last year was very good. That basically led to a big increase in key crops, corn, wheat, and soybeans. Whereas the southern hemisphere struggled with weather developments and leading to very high prices in some like coffee, cotton, sugar, and then, of course, some like cocoa.
Let's go ahead and take a look at cocoa on page 4 in the slide deck. Holy cow, we've seen the price of cocoa, double almost just in the last couple of months and more than triple in the last year. What's the fundamental driver here? What happened?
Simply supply. The cocoa, we have to remember, is dependent on production from a very small part of the world, West Africa, Ghana, Ivory Coast. Weather there has been dismal in the last few months, first too wet and then too hot. We have aging trees struggling to produce. That basically means they need fertilizers and pesticides. The farmers are not reaping the benefits from these higher prices because farm lots are very small. So they are the price they can sell at is dictated by the government or by the exporters. So normally when you have a very high price, you'll also have higher production. But this function is not working in cocoa. And this has led to a lot of head scratching. Many of the big chocolate producers around the world, they buy their cocoa in the forward market, so also in the futures market. And what we've actually seen during the latest run-up in prices, it has not been speculative-driven. Speculators have been net selling cocoa futures for the past 2 months. Instead, the buying has come from producers covering their shorts position, basically covering their hedges against cocoa, the beans they thought they had bought, but which they're suddenly not going to get because of the production is down by close to one third. And this is just leading to this massive scramble for supplies, which is driving up the futures price. And you can see on the chart that is primarily the front end. So the current front contract, the May 24 contract, is screaming above $8,000. The next year, May 2025, is still stuck around $5,000. So that basically leaves us with a massive backwardation of 35%. And it just highlights a market which, in at least for the coming months, will be struggling. And it's leading to another round of shrinkflation, where producers of your chocolate bars will try to maintain revenues by cutting the size of the package. So basically they're reducing the amount of cocoa they need to produce the bar while keeping the price at the same level. So we're most certainly going to see quite a bit of that in the coming months.
Now, normally when I see a commodity move this far on a weather-related phenomenon, the trade there is actually to fade it, to bet the other way. But of course, when we're short, we like to be selling into contango rather than backwardation. So you really, if you try to short this market on a forward basis in next year's contract, you're giving up about a third of that price in terms of where you're in or you're short. Is it a ripe short? Is that why everybody has been selling cocoa futures? Or is it too early for that? What do you? Is there a trading opportunity here?
Considering that the May 25 has remained steady around 5,000 here for, well, the front has been racing high, could it obviously indicate that it's found a bit of a plateau where the market is. And it makes sense because this is the May 25 is the next season, because the current season is more or less done and it looks horrible. The mid-season, which starts in around April, it looks equally bad. So we're not going to have much of a catch up in terms of additional supplies coming from that mid-season crop. Then the focus will be turning to next year's crop. And then the expectations are obviously that at least the farmers will get a higher price than what they received this year. And that will help them fund the need for the different pesticides and fertilizer and so on that's required for these trees to deliver a decent production. So with that in mind, it probably makes sense, but actually selling it with the conditions we've had this year, I think there's probably a risk to that. So it's a tricky trade, Eric. And we're also seeing, as I mentioned, hedge funds have actually been pulling back, getting out of longs, even though the price continues to go up, because this is a market which is just in a flux right now, where it almost goes $1,000 within a matter of days. And that's an extremely tricky one to call a top on.
Let's move on to page 5 and agricultural futures. What is going on here with the food story, and particularly, what is it going to mean from a macro standpoint if we continue to see a lot of these food prices moving higher? This is not exactly an economic environment where consumers can afford higher food prices. What could the consequences be?
We touched a little bit on it earlier, but I think, first of all, we have to say thank God this is not in the reverse, that we are seeing these very, very strong gains occurring to key crops like corn, wheat, and soybeans, because then obviously we could be talking about a food crisis if suddenly we had wheat prices up 200% instead of cocoa. So right now, this is the north-south divide, as I talked about. Soft commodities are they're not strictly necessary for us to live. I suppose many would say a life without coffee would be not a life worth living. I'm probably part of that group. Chocolate bars a little bit more sanguine on that one, but it just highlights how weather become more volatile and how we, at least for the past 6 months or so, have seen this quite big divergence following a period where both sectors were more or less in lockstep, falling at the same rate. But since then, the weather developments, weather developments has occurred, and to bring this big changes in or the divergence between grains and softs. And as I mentioned, If you look at the weekly cut report, the short position, it was reduced a bit in the last week, reporting week, but the short position just recently hit a record high in if you look at corn, wheat and soybeans combined. And this is now in the lull period before we're going with the Northern Hemisphere season. And again, do you really want to be record short when you have potentially some uncertainties starting to potentially unfolding in the months ahead?
Moving on to page 6 and natural gas. Boy, the winter of 2022-2023 was a huge bearish story in natural gas, just crashing prices. It seems like for the last year or so, we've stabilized. I don't know if this is a bottoming pattern. Are we about to go the other direction and move up on natural gas prices?
I think we are, and simply for the reason, several reasons, but as I write there in the headline, the old saying, the best, just like cocoa, where we have high prices, low prices, needed to cure low prices. And I think we're seeing part of that medicine being applied right now with EQT and Tierra Comstock and Chesapeake recently announcing production cuts, simply because inventory levels right now, in, as you can see in the top middle chart there, we got inventory levels around 35% above the five-year average. So that very big overhang of stocks in underground storage ahead of the rebuilding starts very soon. That needs to be brought in back into line in order to support price. And I think we've seen the first step for that to happen. And then we also see the continued expansion of U.S. export capabilities for LNG. That will also continue to attract remove gas out of the country to the rest of the world, and thereby also underpinning prices, which remains extremely cheap relative to the rest of the world. So a massive competitive advantage for U.S. Consumers of natural gas compared to the rest of the world. So I think we are, this $1.5 level is, it looks like it's something, it's a level that's just like OPEC Plus is defending 70 in Brent. I think we, 1.5 is potentially a level that will increasingly be defended by producers simply by cutting production.
Ola, after the Ukraine conflict broke out in the summer of 2022, U.S. natural gas prices topped $10 as there was sudden demand to send a lot of U.S. gas to Europe in order to help them out and so forth. We're down more than 80% now, below $2 from $10. It seems to me like things are really heating up geopolitically, but at the same time, I think the fundamentals are different in terms of Europe's vulnerability. So the question on my mind as I think about a speculative long trade in natural gas is, how vulnerable is Europe at this point if there is a military disruption of some kind due to the escalating geopolitical tension around Gaza and the Red Sea and so forth? Do we have the same kind of vulnerability? Is there a risk of another moonshot to $10?
I think the answer to that is no. Also, part of the reason that we rallied as forcefully as we did back then is similar stories of what we just recently seen in cocoa, where producers or buyers of cocoa have been hedging cocoa by going short the futures market. Utilities in Europe had been selling gas ahead of the spike simply because we were heading towards some sort of an economic slowdown. They had fixed term contracts with Gazprom to receive a certain amount of gas. As they could see, they were not going to need that gas. They sold that gas forward in the futures market. Suddenly, Gazprom turned off the taps. They were left with a short that was not going to be covered by gas coming in, and they had to cover the short, and that really set the ball rolling, and that's why we had these massive spikes back then in European gas prices, where I believe it was 350 euros per megawatt hour, where we're now trading below 30. So that will not be repeated. We are building up LNG import facilities, and a lot of that is coming from the US. We have adjusted to longer sailing routes south of Africa instead of the through the Red Sea. So I think that's also a development we should not be too worried about. But the worry is probably still supplies from Russia, because even though pipeline gas has been reduced significantly, there's only a couple of lines left open selling gas to more Russia-friendly nations in southern Europe. But we also seen LNG from Russia actually picking up, and there's been recent some initiatives trying to curb that sale. So if that is successfully implemented, I doubt it at this point in time. Then it potentially could tighten the market. But overall, we've been lucky once again this winter with another very mild winter. Economic activity has been on the weak side. We're entering this coming season with inventory levels at high levels, which should be relatively manageable to get back up to decent levels by the time winter starts again. And we can already see now winter prices are trading relatively cheap, both for the coming winter and next winter again. So the market is taking quite a sanguine view on the current developments.
Ola, something we've talked about before in your previous interviews, I'd like to come back to, which is backwardation versus contango, and particularly why, for people who are speculating on the long side of commodities, backwardation is your friend. We've discussed this before, but I'd like to go through it again just to make sure it's clear, because even among professional traders outside the commodities community specifically, this concept is not well understood.
No, exactly. And it created quite a few gray hairs, and we'll look at that on the following slide. But yeah, the backwardation is really, in essence, a sign of market being tight. So if you are in need of supplies, you are prepared to pay up to get immediate delivery. And that basically means the spot price is the highest along the whole curve. So further out you go, the prices tend to drop off. And the opposite is contango. Normally, what you would have most markets trading in, if everything was equal and you're only looking at what is the funding cost of holding a commodity position, then commodities should be trading in contango, because we have higher interest rates, we have funding costs. And that basically means if you disregard supply and demand, storage and so on, then all commodities should really a year out in the future should be trading at a 5% discount at a contango. That's simply the cost of financing or the treasury bill for 12 months. So in theory, everything that trades in backwardation is showing strength, because not only is it mitigating offsetting the cost of holding position or funding a position, it also shows how the market is tight. And how does that matter for an investor? It does, simply because whether you are in a futures market or you're in an ETF or a swap or whatever, all these positions are hedged back into the futures market. This is the purest form of trading commodities. And if you have a long position and you're in backwardation, every month the roll takes place. You're selling an expiring contract at a higher price than where you buy the next. So that is giving you a positive roll yield. And that over time, that all these small roll yields that accumulates. And that's why when you look at commodity indices, you have to look at the total return, because the total return takes these rolls, either positive or negative, into account. Vice versa, contango, opposite. You're selling an expiring contract at a lower price than where you're buying the next. That's penalizing you on your return over time. And that's why something like natural gas has been so incredibly difficult to trade from a long perspective, unless you have a very short-term time horizon, because the contango has been quite intrinsic for a long time, and basically mean that you've been eroding your investment slowly over time, and basically making it very expensive to have a long-term view on the market. But turning to page 8, we could just simply see the impact of the backwardation versus contango, because we came up until the pandemic in 2020. We've gone through a number of years where the commodity sector was fairly boring. Supply was ample, and most markets were trading in contango. That basically means in the five-year period from 2016 up until the end of 2020, that does include also the early parts of the post-pandemic rally. But during that period of time, if you look at your spot prices, you would have thought an ETF investment in the Bloomberg Commodity Index would have given you a 47% return. But when you look at your actual account statement, you only made 6%, simply because contango was costing you money on a monthly basis during that time. Fast forward to the last nearly 5 years, what are we up to, 4 years and a bit, since early 2021, where most commodities have been trading in backwardation, similar to the tightness that occurred after the post-pandemic spike in demand for raw materials and all the government support for economic growth. We're seeing during this time that the spot price has been trading as up 21%, but your actual return, if you held an ETF or held a swap tracking this index, you would have made 37%. So it is a major mover, and it is one that this backwardation in the last couple of years has also slowly started to attract newer investors, asset managers and so on, into the commodity space. But what we need right now is clarity about the economic outlook for growth. We need clarity about the direction of interest rates before I think we see the so-called paper demand for commodities picking up in earnest.
Well, moving on to page 9, let's talk about U.S. rate cuts, what they mean. Particularly, you've got the chart here of SOFR futures. As SOFR, of course, is Secured Overnight Financing Rate. Once you know what it stands for, I don't think you're any closer to understanding what it actually means. So maybe you can explain that as well.
The SOFR rates is the way the market can bet on future, on the direction of short-term rates. The ones I just highlighted here is literally the price will more or less reflect the Fed fund rate when it comes to expiry, give or take. So it's a good gauge for where the market is pricing a rate cut expectation. And so for futures, quite often are used when we have these calculations of the percentage chance of a cut in July is so and so, and all these changes. Quite often it's the SOFA futures that makes up this calculation. And what we have seen is since the start of the year, where we really started on a high note in terms of expectations, we were looking for almost 7 rate cuts in 2024. That expectation has deflated quite significantly, and now we're looking at around 3, and we can see the cuts has been moved further and further out. And it does make sense. The market is scratching the head a bit, simply because inflation has come down, but the short-term momentum indicators, looking at the 3 months change on an annual basis and 6 months change as well in the core deflation, they have both started to pick up after they actually for a couple of months were hovering around that 2% inflation target. So the question is really, will they cut? I believe they will. But how much will it be dependent on the direction of inflation? Will they start to look at other issues more than inflation, which potentially could end up being more sticky than originally thought? That is really the uncertainty that we have in in the volatility right now in the bond markets and in these short-term rates.
Higher interest rates tend to lead to a sharper contango or less backwardation. What else do we need to know about changing interest rates and how they affect commodity markets?
Simply because it's the cost of money. And if the cost of money comes down, then it should obviously support economic activity. It also supports the companies who have been bringing down their inventory, the stock levels of key commodities in order to bring down their funding cost, especially last year. And that's the so-called restocking cycle, which we look towards as adding some additional physical demand to the market, not only the paper demand, which is through the futures and which can be carried out by asset managers and so on and hedge funds, CTAs, but also actual real demand from end users restocking, simply because the cost of money starts to come down and making it more interesting again. But at the same time, it has to be coincide with the expectations that the economic outlook has stabilized, and we're looking for higher growth in the months ahead. And yet the jury is probably still also out on that one, especially in the US, where some of the signs are still that we are probably not going to see recession, but at least the economic outlook could show some weakness. But then at the same time, other parts of the world are benefiting from lower funding costs and potentially with that also a weaker dollar.
Let's move on to slide 10 and a topic that's near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts, which is precious metals. Ola, I'm going to be the first to admit that I don't really understand this big bull move up that we've seen in the last month or so. It seems pretty darn clear that it was Fed Commissioner Waller's comments that the market interpreted in a way that was the catalyst for this big move. Honestly, I don't understand. I heard what he said. I don't understand how that translates to, what was it, $150 move in gold in a matter of a few days? Am I missing something? Is there a clear reason that I don't understand why this happened?
I think we're all missing something, and I think there's no clear explanation to why it happened now. I think a lot of commentators expected the move to happen, but not at a time where we've just gone through a sharp reduction in the expectations for rates. We can see that there on slide 10. This is where the Fed funds is expected to be by either July and December. And you can see by July, we're now looking at just around one cut. And by December, we're looking at less than 3 from close to 7. And despite of this, the market has moved higher. I think there's probably a couple of things. And the underlying physical demand, we should not ignore. It's extremely strong, especially in China, where investors, the middle class in China, they're faced with a stock market, which up until recently was struggling quite a bit, as property market, which is no longer a safe place to put your retirement money than it used to. And they are looking, with the limited amount of investable products they have, gold has become a hot topic. Central banks, we all know, have been continued to buy. There was, I think there's even recently some talk that Russia's dollars that was held at the central banks around the world should be confiscated and used to put towards rebuilding Ukraine. I can't even imagine what kind of impact that would have for the global system if that was to be the case. But there's just thought of that, I'm sure, is likely to have added some additional demand from central banks getting out the dollar. So that's one part. And I think we just have to look at the CUT report on the week, the data. the demand through the futures demand has just exploded. In the last two reporting weeks, hedge funds bought 250 tons of gold, and that's basically a quarter of what all central banks bought in a whole year, and they bought that in 2 weeks. That is a massive amount of gold that is adding to a squeeze in the price. So I would say this move has been momentum, technical breakout driven, and that also means that for now, this rally is built on a bit of a shaky foundation. We all know hedge funds are not married to the position. I used to work for one. They will change the outlook if there is a change in the technical or the fundamental outlook. The fundamental outlook has changed somewhat to a little bit towards the negative side, but the technical for now is holding up. So I would be cautious of calling this the new leg higher. I think it's perhaps happened a bit too soon. It really all depends on whether we get any data that adds some downward pressure on the price and then potentially forces the ball to roll. Because what we have to remember, hedge funds, they will buy into strength and sell into weakness. But at the same time, they will maintain the same risk to a given market. So if they bought at 100 and the market went to 120, they buy again, then they'll move the stop higher. So their stop loss on the new bigger position is still the same as it was at the entry level of the position. And that is key to remember, that the stop losses on these longs have been moved higher as the price moved higher. And that basically means, well, they are closer to the market than they were initially. But the good thing is that the rally was, as you mentioned, $150+, meaning that these levels are stops are probably at this point in time relatively far away from the current spot market. So we can take quite a bit of heat without triggering some of these stops, which otherwise could trigger a cascade of sell orders, even though there's not been any major change in the outlook.
The title on page 11 is "Too Much Too Soon" with a question mark on it. It seems to me, you know, we had the second hot inflation print in a row last week. That seems to have capped the rally. Now we're starting the correction. I just wonder how far the correction has. I think it is a buy the dip opportunity, probably. The question is, are we going all the way back down to, you know, 2100 or below? I guess the breakout zone was 2085, 2087, something like that. Are we going all the way there on this correction, or are we just going halfway there? What do you think?
I would say I hope not, because if we do take that 2080, 80, 90 area out, then I think we are into that territory where stops will start to hit the market. And again, speculators, hedge funds, they do not ask questions. They fire, they shoot first. If they're wrong, they get out, and then they take another look when the price tells them to get back in again. So this move potentially could have nothing to do with fundamentals, more simply positioning being adjusted. So I think for now, I'm keeping a close eye on that 2135 area. That was the previous peak on spot gold. I'd like to see it hold that area. I would get a little bit more nervous if we break below. But I think what's also important, what we saw last week was gold holding reasonably well through these higher, hotter than expected inflation print. And I think part of that was silver picking up the baton simply because of the rally we saw in copper, which were for other reasons, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But silver's rally last week, I think, helped cushion gold. And the question is whether that can be maintained into this week. So we're not a million miles away from critical levels, but still have some miles to go before, or some dollars to go before we start to get worried.
On page 12, you're showing 2,300 as an upside target. What's the time frame for that, and what do you see on the horizon even further out?
I see that when we start to get the rate cuts, and those rate cuts has to be at least the three that we have priced in at this point in time. So when we get, and just also just highlight one of the previous slides where we, and I'm sure most of you have seen that one before, that the previous rate cut cycles in this during the past 20 years have all led to very strong rallies in gold. This time round, the rally has started even before the cuts started to materialize, but that's the market likes to run ahead of itself sometimes. But 2300 was, I'll call it, the start of the year. The fact that if this rally that we've seen just recently managed to stick without the rate cuts, and then adding the rate cuts on top of that later in the year, then potentially 2500, which is the upper range of that potential long-term channel going all the way back to 2007, that could be the target. But 2300 into the second half is my call.
Let's move on to copper, which has moved extraordinarily just in the last week or so. What is going on both long-term, and also what's been the driver short-term for this big surge higher in copper prices?
Well, first of all, it's a technical-driven rally once again. Funds have been trading this from a short side for a while, and they've been forced to get back into the market. But the fundamental trigger behind the rally is news out of China. China is the biggest refinery hub for refined metals in the world. And as we've seen producers, mining companies around the world downgrade their production forecasts over the year, and also with the Panama, the copper mine surging down in Panama last year, that has started to tighten the availability of supply of copper. And that basically means all these smelters in China, they've been increasingly been faced with a lower supply. And what you do in order to attract supply, well, you make it more cheaper to refine the copper in order to get supplies. So that competition has been a race to the bottom. So refining charges, treatment refinery charges in China is at one point almost hit zero, which basically means they're not making money. They're most certainly losing money. And that's led to a decision last week that they will try to curb production simply in order to lift the profitability. So, and if they do that, the finished product of refined copper will suffer as well. So this is kind of a catch 22, both basically in my mind leading to higher prices over time, and with these supply cuts really starting to be felt into the second half, then I agree with that this is a market that has been asleep for a while, simply because we had to deal with the property crisis in China. We've had to deal with the sharply lower growth expectations, sharply higher interest rates around the world, forcing destocking of mined metals. And despite of all this, copper is now starting to move higher after this period of consolidation, and I believe we are at the start of a move that will continue to gain some traction. Also, simply if that momentum comes back to the market, then there will be the added tailwind from funds starting having to get back into the market, having traded this with a close to neutral position for almost a year.
Slide 14: energy transition metals. What's the story here?
Just that it looks like we may be starting to see a few green shoots. If you look at equity baskets and equity themes over the last year, boy, everything that's related to green transformation has been hammered. And some of these metals has suffered significant losses as well. Just take a look at the chart here where we see the year to date, the worst performing is the mining lithium miners. The best performing is the actual lithium carbonate contract or benchmark in China. So it does indicate that miners are lacking right now what looks like a start of a recovery in prices. And part of this is just like natural gas, driven by producers cutting back production simply because prices tanked by 80% over the last year, back to where they more or less were before the massive spike we saw a couple of years ago. And that has led to some production curtailment, and that's starting to support the lithium price again. So lithium and copper, again, two key green metals that show signs of finding their feet here. So that's basically the main story, I would say, from this one.
Now, I notice you've got some comments on the right-hand side of page 14 about nuclear power, but you don't have uranium on the chart. Any thoughts on where uranium is headed?
Uranium is heading higher, but for now, it's just like many other speculative, or it has become a very speculative market. We saw a rush of new investors rushing into the market, both into mining companies, but also into ETFs, tracking companies and ETFs tracking physical uranium, to the extent that we probably we overextended ourselves to the upside, because we have to remember the uranium rally is a multi-decade rally. This is not happening overnight. Nuclear plants are not built on a daily basis. We know more or less exactly what will be needed over time. And what will be needed over time is rising, and that will underpin prices. But I think it was victim of a speculative bubble that drove uranium spot prices to around $105 a pound. Now we're back into the 80s, and we've seen some of this the speculative froth getting out of the market. It was a typical buy rumor, sell fact market. We rallied strongly in January on expectation that both Kazakhstan and Cameco in Canada would cut their production outlook. That materialized as expected, but the market had already taken that had rallied quite substantially on the back of that. So right now it's just a question of I think we need to see if this market consolidates. I'm watching something like the Sprott Physical Trust. the discount to NAV at one point last week hit 15%. So you could basically buy the trust 15% below net asset value. That has since come down. But when you see these kind of spikes, that is obviously an indication that there is quite a lot of selling activity coming into the market from people wanting to get out. And everyone that got in January was basically underwater, and that's led to this correction. But the long-term outlook, I believe, is very positive for the uranium, for the commodity, and for the miners in general.
I agree completely, and I did buy quite a bit at the 15% discount last week. Page 15 in crude oil.
Yeah, crude oil. What can we say? We looks like we are starting to wake up a little bit. We have been struggling in a relatively tight range for a long time. Just early last week, the weekly average on a monthly rolling basis hit the lowest level in 10 years. So the market was really just content with sitting here boxing around with Brent around 80 and WTI a bit lower. But since then, the market has started to firm up a bit. And of course, we all know the reasons for that. The main catalyst is still the tightness, OPEC plus keeping barrels off the market. We've seen drone strikes hitting plants in Russia, lifting gasoline and diesel prices simply because Russia's export of diesel and gasoline may be at risk. And perhaps if it, worst case scenario, they have to import stuff. So that's driving up the cost of refined products. That's underpinning crude oil. But also IEA last week came out saying, based on the assumption that OPEC will keep supplies tight for the remainder of the year, they see now a deficit starting to emerge in the second half, a daily small deficits emerging, which will underpin prices. The upside is still one I'm a little bit doubtful about, simply because rallying higher prices with higher spare capacities rarely go hand in hand. And what we have seen with these production cuts from OK, especially some of those in the Middle East where taps can be turned on again relatively easy, spare capacity has been rising to levels which would normally not warrant a spike in prices. And at the same time, the Middle East situation remains uncertain, but at the same time, there's just a sense that almost no matter how bad it gets, there's not really any appetite for this conflict to start impacting the production and the transportation of crude away from the main production areas.
Saudi Arabia really got my attention when they announced recently that they're not intending, or actually they've reversed their prior decision to make further investments in their productive resources in Saudi Arabia. They're not going to increase beyond their current production capacity, and they've made that announcement to the market. What do you make of that?
Simply that they don't see the need for it, but also at the same time, what's the point spending billions of dollars expanding your capacity if you may not need it anytime soon? And also just simply the fact that they are producing quite a bit less than that can right now. So I think it's more keep the money at work somewhere else instead of trying to put them into investment that may not necessarily pay off anytime soon. And whether it's a signal that we are approaching peak oil, I think that's probably taking it a bit too far in terms of trying to analyze why they did. I think simply they see there's no need for spending all those billions of dollars at this point in time, and that they can obviously revert that decision at any moment in time if they feel that's necessary or in the years to come.
Page 16, Ola, one of the most valuable tools that we have in commodities trading is the government-supplied Commitment of Traders report. But the government's version of that report is so cryptic that it's really hard to follow. You provide a tremendous service where you kind of translate the government data into graphs and charts in very readable format. And you do that for free, which is really a phenomenal service. Why do you do that, and where can people find it?
Well, first of all, I do it because I used to work for a hedge fund myself in my days in London for nearly 10 years. I know how they operate, at least some of them, how the information that they have to provide to the authorities, how that is useful for everyone who may not be buying and selling massive amounts of contracts on a daily basis. And because what I say, hedge funds are, as I put into this little text there, they're quite often being accused of driving prices, but they try to anticipate but then also accelerate and amplify price changes that has been set in motion already. They are not the ones starting a move. They will join a move when the momentum tells them this is the right thing to do. But at the same time, as also mentioned earlier, they are never married to their positions. Unlike us, who potentially is sometimes at risk with our investment becoming married to the position when it starts to go wrong, believing that we are right over time and the market is wrong, they don't have the luxury. They will respond if the price doesn't react as they were hoping for, as their position is telling them. And that basically means as well, they will be found holding the biggest long at a turn of a peak, when the market peaked. They'll also be found holding the biggest short at the bottom of the market. And that's why sometimes people call them dumb money. They're absolutely nothing, anything but dumb. They will be in these moves for as long as possible, as long as momentum tells them to. So they will only get out when they have to. So I think otherwise they will obviously all be out of business if it was dumb money. But it gives us mere mortals a good idea about what they're doing in terms of positioning. If the size starts to become very elevated, that does obviously raise the risk. Well, if something changes in the market, if the technical or fundamental outlook changes, combined with the knowledge of the positions they hold, then we can assume that something potentially major could happen. And just look at gold right now. As I said, the last 2 weeks, the last week it was a change with 28,500 lots that was added, quite a substantial more than the previous week, adding up to these 200 plus tons that I mentioned. But that net now is now the highest we've seen in a couple of years, obviously leaving it exposed if we do see a change in the price action. So that's why we're watching that. We're watching all these reds in the grains, as I mentioned, shorts across the board into the spring. And then also interestingly, something like the cocoa, as I mentioned, where the cocoa short long is much reduced compared to where it was just a few months ago. So it's basically a radar, knowing what they hold. And then combine that with the market activity, and that gives you a good idea about when things potentially could start to get a bit risky.
Well, Ola, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, as always. One final question before we go, though. I mean, everybody knows the big theme this year has been inflation. You guys at Saxo Bank have actually gotten some attention for slashing your fees on your online trading platform. You're going opposite the direction. I'm sure that's appreciated by a lot of traders. What's the motivation for that? And also, be sure to tell us where our listeners can find your research on the Commitment of Traders reports that you just described.
Well, thank you, Eric. Well, first and foremost, we want to be competitive. Who doesn't? But at the same time, also just the knowledge of how trading commissions erodes your return over time. So our business is built on long-term relationship. We obviously like to have clients staying with us and growing with us, and a way to do that is also to ensure that when they do enter the market, that they enter the market at decent levels in terms of cost. So that was introduced back in rollingly being introduced across the world. We started with that process back in January. But otherwise, Eric, you can obviously always find me on Twitter. I put in the handle there. I don't talk about recipes and dogs and cats. It's really only commodities most of the time, almost I would say 99% of the time. Perhaps sometimes a picture from the seas around Copenhagen, which is cold this time of year, but beautiful to swim in during the summer. And then also, if you into our website, analysis.saxo, where I've got great content from all my colleagues around the world focusing on the different asset classes.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was a great interview with Ole. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Ole Hansen's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a drawdown of 2 million barrels of crude oil, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down a de minimis 18,000 barrels, gasoline drawing down 3.3 million barrels, distillates building 624,000 barrels, for a net petroleum drawdown of 4.6 million barrels. U.S. production held steady at 13.1 million barrels, unchanged from last week. We've got a clear breakout above $80. That was the round number resistance we were fighting with for the last few weeks. That suggests further upside to come. But echoing what Ola said, I can't get too excited in an environment of increasing spare capacity for this rally to go too much farther. So I don't think we're headed back towards $100 prices anytime soon, unless there's a geopolitical escalation. And of course, anything is possible on that front.
Well, Eric, it was a very clean breakout on crude oil, and it remains well above its 50-day moving average. The pattern of higher highs and higher lows continues. And I get the whole idea of spare capacity and a lot of the reasons why a lot of people are relatively skeptical about the sustainability of this rally. But the one thing I reflect on is that the substantial volatility, both to the upside and downside, is an inherent feature. And right now, the sentiment, not very many people are buying into this oil rally. For me, it still wouldn't be a shocker if the oil market made a couple pushes higher. Like, even though all of you will end up being right that that spare capacity kept oil trade ranged, it doesn't mean we can't print 90 before going back to 75 and the average price for the year ends up in the low 80s. And so here, the trend is still in your favor. And if old dips end up being bought in the $79, $80 area that keep it above the 50-day moving average, I'm still in the camp that there could be a few more bullish impulses on the upside of crude. So let's move on to equities. Eric, what's your thinking here?
Well, the FOMC statement and Jay Powell's dovish comments in the presser propelled stocks higher. As I've said before, I see this as a melt-up that doesn't make a lot of fundamental sense, but it shows all the signs of continuing higher.
All right. Well, I want to get Nick involved in this conversation. Nick, on page 3, we have the S&P 500 index with your levels. So what are you thinking here, bud?
Spot price right now on SPX is approximately 5250. We have a call wall above at 5250 and a put wall below at 5100. Now, the implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX is plus minus 130 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 5350 and the lower implied move is 5090. Right now, we have key resistance above at 5250, all-time highs, and key support below at 5100. I'm inclined to think we see a pop now toward that 5300 mark as we get a blow-off top in the market, given Powell's commentary. And right now, we have the next FOMC meeting coming April 30th and May 1st. So that's probably the next volatility-inducing event we're going to see. But until then, I'm kind of bullish short-term.
On page 4, I have that S&P 500 futures chart on the continuous with that 50-day moving average. And the one thing we've seen relentlessly since the start of the year, literally started in January, was this pattern of higher highs and higher lows in this crawl higher. And every single dip gets bought pretty much systematically at the exact same time. You know, a quick little retrace, multiple days, and then pops higher. We're already slowly approaching some of the short-term swing high targets, which you know, would be expected to have a similar pattern, which is it pauses, retraces, and then advances again. It clearly is that the primary trend is up. The bulls are in control. Higher highs, higher lows. Price action is bullish that way. But this is an incredibly overextended market. And really, at some point, all it will take is one surprise catalyst, and quickly everyone that is rushing to buy simply because they feel that this primary trend is in control will quickly start to try to flatten their positioning. What will that trigger be? I don't know. But right now, the bulls are in control. On the S&P futures, I'm looking for about 5350, which is about 40 more S&P points higher, and we'll see whether or not the market consolidates there. And moving on to the NASDAQ chart here, Nick, what levels are you watching?
Spot price on Qs right now is approximately 446. We have a call wall above at 450 all-time highs and a put wall below at 435. The implied move for the April 19th monthly OPEX is plus minus 16 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is fresh all-time highs at 462 and the lower implied move is at 430. Right now, we have key resistance at all-time highs at 450 and key support at 430. As I mentioned on the S&P, I'm bullish short-term. Longer-term, I'm more cautious, especially on tech names. I mentioned last week that Google and Apple were longer-term buys as they were hitting their lows. And Google had a nice bounce on Monday with that news that they're going to possibly be licensing their Gemini software to Apple. Apple also popped at that news as well. But I'm short-term bullish on certain names. I'm being very selective here. I'm not, you know, broad market saying I'm bullish overall. You got to be very, very selective as we hit these new highs.
All right. Well, looking on page six here, Nick, we have the volatility index, and here we are at the 12 handle. I mean, at this stage, the bull continues. There was a little bit of volatility premium priced in for just in case the Fed meeting became a pivot. But clearly now in the post-Fed period, we're coming right back down to the year lows. What are the VIX levels telling you?
Yeah, so with the VIX at approximately 13, we can expect intraday top-to-bottom moves of approximately 0.75%. And right now, what we're seeing with the VIX near lows is very, very cheap insurance on longer-term time horizons. That being out-of-the-money puts in the event of some exogenous event occurring, causing market volatility to increase suddenly. As I mentioned previously, the next FOMC meeting is April 30th and May 1st. So that might be the next volatility-inducing event. But right now, given that we're in this swing to the upside with the bulls in control, it's hard to really say that buying puts in the short term would make a lot of sense. I do think that volatility will decline into that FOMC event. Thereafter is anyone's guess. Now, moving on to page seven, we have the US dollar index. What are you guys thinking here?
The FOMC statement seemed at first to suggest that the Fed didn't think inflation is done, just as Jim Bianco told us recently here on Macro Voices. And the dot plot seemed to indicate that further hiking was on deck in 2025 and beyond, but not until they first made sure they got those three rate cuts in between now and the election, which of course is not at all politically motivated in any way. Then Jay's speech crushed those hawkish interpretations when he insisted that the dots don't represent a plan or strategy. I think Jim Bianco has it exactly right. Inflation has probably bottomed, and the fantasy of many traders that we were about to begin a rate-cutting cycle that would take us all the way back down to 2% or 0% treasury rates or whatever they thought was going to happen. No, I don't think so. I think we're going to get a few rate cuts in 2024, which seemed to me to be politically motivated, and then the data seems to suggest that we may go back to a hiking cycle after that. Now, if Jim Bianco is right on the timing, that means May or June for the first cut.
My view is that the dollar hasn't revealed its hand yet. The 104 was a very key level for the dollar to beat. And as it approached it, it stalled out there and it certainly paused there in the post-FOMC. But at the same time, all pullbacks in the dollar have actually been very well contained and bold. And on top of that, you have the US dollar yen about to break to a fresh high. And so the dollar index itself is in the dead center of its one-year trade range, and it really hasn't shown its hand. At some point, the dollar will signal some sort of intermarket move and a lot of risk assets will reflect. But right now, the dollar is somewhat trendless and FOMC was not the trigger for a big currency move. And so we'll wait to see whether or not some sort of more meaningful move happens here. Right now, just respecting the trade range is all that we can really do.
Now, on page eight, we have that gold futures chart with gold breaking to new all-time highs. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I was expecting and hoping for a deeper correction in gold so that I could put some more size on my long position. But of course, as soon as Jay Powell crushed those expectations that were set by the dot plot, we were at new all-time highs by Wednesday's close. So the correction is probably over and 2300 is likely the next near-term upside target, just as Ole Hansen said in this week's feature interview. The longer-term cup and handle pattern still has targets around 2725, but that could take a year or more to play out. And given the dot plot, I'll be taking profits on my gold longs around election time later this year.
Eric, the 2300 number that you suggested as a near-term target has been a number I've been watching closely as well. And I am in the camp where on the very short term, gold is in an uptrend, making higher highs, pushing trend, taking flows. No reason why something like 2300 couldn't be achieved. In the bigger picture, though, the real big gold bull market is likely to be occurring during an easing cycle, during a period where the dollar is generally weak in some sort of a downtrend. We haven't seen those bigger picture conditions really start yet. So after gold finishes this move, it would be very natural for it to backfill and retrace. Overall, gold's been very bullish, all-time new highs, holding up along there. There's no reason not to believe gold will stay up there. The bigger question is, this the beginning of this extraordinary move that will hit 2700 or 3000 on the upside? And while I think over time those upper targets are 100% in play, the question is this breakout we just saw here in March that beginning of that move? And that the jury's still out on that. I agree with you on the 2300. We definitely have room to go a little bit higher on the short term, but it'll all be about the way it consolidates here into the summer that will be the big tell for me.
Now, to finish up, guys, we have this chart on uranium. What are your thoughts?
I was hoping for another leg down before the correction ended, but it's starting to look like the bottom is probably already in, although it's early to say that with conviction. The deep value play here, if you don't mind some geopolitical risk, is in Global Atomic, a ticker symbol GLO. Now, the backstory here is Niger, and if you're not sure what I'm talking about, the West African country that's uranium-rich and looks to English speakers like it ought to be pronounced Niger. Well, that's a French-speaking place, so it's pronounced Niger. And their situation, they had a coup, essentially. They have a military junta which is in control. They were accused by the United States of maybe getting ready to sell uranium to Iran, and they didn't take very well to that. I think the United States felt like they were going to test their mettle or something, and the reaction of the military in Niger was basically, get out of our country, you're not welcome here. And the U.S. is now backpedaling and saying, well, but wait a minute, we were going to build a couple of very strategic bases here, you have to let us stay. What do you think you are, a sovereign country that gets to make up your own rules? We're the United States. So I don't know where this is headed. I don't perceive that there's really any great risk to, you know, nationalization of uranium assets or anything like that. I suppose there is maybe a risk that the United States gets into a spat with the current regime. I think it's more likely that they're going to work this out. But one way or another, I thought that Global Atomic was a screaming buy when it was north of $3. Our friend Justin Hune over at UraniumInsider.com thought the same thing. He thought it was a buy around $3. And we ended up touching almost down to $2 in this reaction to the news in Niger. There is clearly geopolitical risk here. Of course, there's always the possibility that this stock goes to zero if you had, a nationalization or some really crazy kind of event. I don't think the political cards, as I'm reading them, are setting up for that kind of event. I think the U.S. is going to have to swallow a little bit of crow and eat their words, and they'll get to build their military base. And this is probably a deep value play. Everything else is off its bottoms, whereas Global Atomic is the only thing that's trading right on its cycle lows as we speak.
Eric, whether there was one more dip or not, and you got a chance to buy it a few dollars better, I think the consensus was on the show that this is a buy on dip. I don't see any reason why it's not. Ultimately, uranium had a great run. It was a 9-month advance that saw an extraordinary 100+ advance. Those rallies get checked. And after primary trend moves like that, these secondary corrections wash out weak hands, people that were chasing performance, people that weren't there for the high conviction, and or simply trend followers that got signals that the short-term trend was over. Ultimately, this is now retraced close to half of its gain. And after that kind of a correction is typically when buy on dip traders start to emerge. And so you can see on the chart that we're approaching the 50-day moving average. This would be a level where, if broken, and especially if we can get above $30 on this chart, that it may signal that we are re-resuming some sort of new bull trend. Have we beat the 50-day? No. Have we beat that $30 level? No. So there's a lot of things that still have to happen, but this correction has been already a month plus. It's already gone deep enough. So watching whether or not uranium starts to bull here is certainly on my mind.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck provided by Ole Hansen and the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, including a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.